Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Thank you so much for joining. It is a pleasure, as always, to be with you, and I consider it a privilege that you have chosen to spend some of your time with me. I hope you will find this show to be a good show. And I'm going to describe what this is. This is not one of the interview shows. Every now and again, I like to run what I call a dystopia update, in which I give you some of the recent news from the tech industry that shows how the tech companies are attempting to further change our lives, our culture, our daily rhythms, our expectations, and to move that Overton window just a little bit further in their favor at our expense. And this is one of those shows. As I said, it's not an interview show. Last week, we had a great interview with members of the Luddite Club. This is an interview, a live in-studio interview. You can listen to that at tectonic.fm if you missed it, tectonic.fm. But and that's the kind of interview show that I like to do most weeks. But every now and then, there is a profusion of tech news that just calls out for highlighting, and that's what we're doing this evening, because I have been collecting these for the last, I don't know how many weeks, and just thinking, I have to tell the listeners about this one, I've got to update them on this one, and so we'll go ahead and dive in. We're going to dive into this dystopia update. The first story that I saw that I wanted to share with you was a story out of the Wall Street Journal. It's what they call an A-head. This is if you've ever seen the print version of the Wall Street Journal, there's always one fun article on the front page, and this was which they call the A-head. That was this one. It's called "Should You Be Nice to Your Chatbot?" This is from October 14, and you know, we've got chatbots popping up everywhere now. When OpenAI launched ChatGPT, what was this now, about 2 years ago, that was the 3.5 version that really got the public's attention. When that happened, there was an incredible wave of interest in these interactive chatbots. And so companies started trying to figure out how to plug those into various applications, devices, environments, kiosks, and we're going to talk after this story. We're going to talk about one of the particular applications. But as chatbots are becoming more and more common, more and more popular, the inevitable question that the companies are starting to seed into the cultural conversation is what the chatbot's expectations of our behavior should be. What are the expectations of our behavior, rather than putting the focus on the chatbot, which, you know, chatbots so often are engaged in what are euphemistically called hallucinations. Clear or accurate term would be errors. But instead of bringing more attention onto the chatbot's accuracy, we now have this story saying, how should we act? How should the humans act when in the presence of a chatbot? And so here's a clip from this Wall Street Journal story. As talking to chatbots is now becoming more like normal conversations, AI users face an awkward ethical dilemma. Really? Do we face an awkward ethical dilemma? Well, that's what the story says. And the dilemma is as follows. Bots are programmed to be polite, but do we have to reciprocate? Is it wrong to speak harshly to them? And I, just the framing of this question, I have to take exception to, as though we have any responsibility to this soulless bag of algorithms, as though we have to change our attitude in how we relate to some circuits in a big tech cloud server somewhere. Why is the question about how we need to change? It's a complete deflection. And I understand, you know, it's sort of a fun story. It's a funny way of framing an A-head. I'm not complaining to the Wall Street Journal here. This is their job to have a fun story. But all kidding aside, this is the kind of question that is going to become more common and more expected. Again, reference the Overton window. What is within the bounds of normal expectation? This is the kind of question that we're going to hear more of. And so let me read you the other clip I have from this story. This is a quote from Alana O'Grady, an executive at a tech startup based in Silicon Valley. Quote, "The litmus test for how good a person you are is if you are nice to a waiter. In the future, it'll be how kind you are to your AI companion." I don't know how to say no to this strongly enough. There is any equivalence between being polite to someone who is a human being who is serving you at your table, let's say at a restaurant, and again, how we as human beings are now going to be expected to act when we face a corporate digital interface that likely is coded with its own manipulations that are tuned to benefit the corporation and its shareholders, possibly at our own expense. I mean, just look at the errors, not hallucinations, the errors in Google's own AI answers that, for example, had the Google answers instructing people to add glue to their pizza recipe. Again, it's a way for Google to try to compete with OpenAI and try to show that it's up on things and it's investing a lot in AI. If it results in some bodily harm to the human users, well, that's just too bad because we are adding shareholder value. Why in that situation is the question how the humans should act, how the humans should relate to this corporate interface? I totally disagree with this framing. And I just wanted to bookmark that because in our dystopia update, this is a little signal, again, not a criticism of the journal here in this case, but this is, we can take this as an early signal of what the companies are going to try to frame the question as in years to come. Rather than us interrogating what they're doing, they're going to say, why don't you, the humans, watch your mouth? And we should be prepared to resist that. Now, speaking of these chatbots, I said that chatbots are popping up everywhere. And there's a story that I came across from October 23. This is from the Axios newsletter. It sends me tech news 5 or 6 days a week. And the Axios newsletter was talking about how cars are now being planned that will have chatbots and surveillance capabilities installed. So I'm not saying that these new model cars yet have it, but there are plans afoot explicitly, and this article covers this. Quote, Qualcomm announced yesterday that it is bringing its next generation Orion processor to its in-car computer systems for both entertainment and automated driving. Mercedes said that it would use Qualcomm's Snapdragon Cockpit Elite chip to power future in-car information systems. And then Qualcomm also announced a partnership with Google to jointly promote Android Auto and Qualcomm's Digital Cockpit. Okay, there's a lot of company names here and brand names here. I'm not listing these. I'm certainly not listing these to give these companies any publicity, but I'm just trying to give you a sense of these are very large and very wealthy and very powerful companies that are all partnering together to get their chips and their software and their platforms and so on all installed in cars, in brands such as Mercedes. So you can guess that if Mercedes starts installing this surveillance chatbot, other brands that try to follow Mercedes' lead are likely to do this as well. And so what exactly is this AI chatbot supposed to do inside the car? Aren't cars for driving and, you know, keeping your eyes on the road and not being super distracted? No, not anymore. This is VP of Engineering for Android at Google. And keep in mind, friends, this is a VP of Android, which is a mobile operating system at Google, holding forth on the future of the car industry. So Google is now announcing to all of us what's going to happen to all of our cars soon enough. Quote, "We think people will be able to truly converse with their cars, not just like an AI chatbot, but actually with intelligence about what the vehicle can see, what the vehicle knows about itself, and, this is the important one, what it knows about the driver." And Google, true to form, can't do anything without building on a foundation of surveillance of the people using and in the vicinity of the Google system. So if Google talks about an AI chatbot in a car, you can go ahead and fill in the word surveillance. It is a surveillance AI chatbot in the car that is being built by Google. So Google, soon enough, will be in new model cars, watching you, listening to you, purely for your convenience, you understand. This is Google's line. It simply wants to know all about you. Not because we are the world's leading surveillance capitalist advertising market. No, not at all. We simply want to make your ride more intelligent or something. No. Let's be clear. What Google is trying to do is to extend their surveillance empire into cars so that they can watch you, they can listen to you, they can apply any kinds of sensors to you, your family, your kids, your friends, your other passengers in order to extend their surveillance dossier on you for further monetization. Let's continue with this Axios story. The power increases further when AI is combined with self-driving abilities. And so the idea is the car would say, I see an empty parking spot over there. Great, you know, because drivers, how did we ever find parking spots before? But here's the real kicker. There's a company in China called Li Auto. And apparently I'm reading from Axios again, China's Li Auto showed an AI assistant that can answer all the questions that kids ask while you're in the car, while also powering travel-related and entertainment tasks and remembering its owner's preferences, again, being built on the surveillance foundation. So also with Chinese companies presumably not working off of Google Android, although perhaps, but whether it's a Chinese surveillance stack or a Google surveillance stack, what's the difference really? What they're trying to sell us is an AI chatbot that the best they can come up with is, number one, that the car is going to help with parking. And number two, I just love this, that the chatbot will answer the questions that your kids ask. So if you're a parent and you are driving, or you are a parent and you're in the passenger seat. Both, let's say there are two parents. The two parents, I suppose, want to buy a new car where they can have a pact, where they never have to talk to their kids again within the vicinity of an AI chatbot. Allow the AI chatbot to answer the questions. Daddy, why is the sky blue? Talk to the AI chatbot. Daddy, what state are we in? Talk to the AI chatbot. I don't have time for this. What a great family interaction when we can defer our relationship with our own kids to a Google or correspondingly large company platform to filter and manipulate and, again, shape and mold the relationship however it sees fit in order to, first, benefit its growth at any cost ethos, second, the shareholders who will benefit financially from that system, and third, a distant third, possibly to do something that may occasionally be helpful or useful or amusing when it is not actively hallucinating in the presence of kids. All of this made me perk up when I heard, and I think this was from a listener, sent me a link to a video. This was a panel conversation back in February held in Canada between Shoshana Zuboff and Jim Balsillie. Jim Balsillie, the co-founder of Research in Motion that made the BlackBerry devices, and Shoshana Zuboff, who is a past guest on this show. She wrote The Age of Surveillance Capitalism several years ago, in which she talked about the genesis of this new economic system that really came from Google, and then Facebook adopted it second. And those two companies have really pioneered it, with the rest of big tech falling in line ever since. Shoshana Zuboff, and I've put a link to this and all the other stories if you want to check this out. This is all on the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. This is the dystopia update. The surveillance capitalism video has Zuboff talking about she gives a history of surveillance capitalism, kind of summarizing her book. I'm not going to play you that. I just want to play a minute or two of where she talks about surveillance capitalism now spreading. So this is kind of her own dystopia update, telling us what has happened to surveillance capitalism since her book came out, and see if you can see the link to this Axios story I just talked about. Here it is.
The massive scale extraction of human-generated data, ubiquitous, inescapable, for profit. Today, surveillance capitalism has become the dominant economic paradigm across every sector, in every industry. Some of you may have seen recently, because I know many of you are immersed in this subject, Mozilla research that was published last month. 25 top global automobile brands. Every single one of them has shifted from making their margins on selling vehicles to using the vehicle as a loss leader for the data they can collect from your engagement with their vehicle and everything they can do with those data. That's where the margins come from now. Surveillance capitalism has redefined education, healthcare, finance, real estate. There is no industry that has escaped this structural shift. Surveillance capitalism is now a global institutional order, fully entrenched not only in our economy, but now, and we'll talk about this later, and this will be the final thing I say, so powerful that it has the audacity and the confidence to go head to head with democratic governance, democratic governments over who will control the future of knowledge, the future of society, and the future of our information civilization.
Okay, and that was, again, Shoshana Zuboff speaking back in February about the history of surveillance capitalism, and then in that clip, how surveillance capitalism has now spread and proliferated into industries well beyond big tech, where it was born a number of years back. And she brings up the car industry in particular, referencing a Mozilla privacy study, which I talked about on the show when it came out several months ago, that Mozilla looked at the privacy policies of the major car brands and found that all of them failed basic privacy tests. They were all surveilling drivers and passengers without those human beings' knowledge or consent or ability to appeal, or even in some cases, really ability to turn off the surveillance using the settings in the car. Of course, the car companies made the options really hard to find and complicated and poorly designed in a way to try to retain as much right as they could to continue surveilling their users. So you can see that the Axios story is talking about surveillance in cars, and this is exactly what Shoshana was talking about several months before. In addition, Zuboff mentioned a detail in that Mozilla story that I don't think I brought up earlier when I covered the report in the first case, which was that in some cases, the car companies are now selling the cars as loss leaders in order to monetize the surveillance of the driver and passengers for the profit, for their margins. And so now what we have is cars being turned over into the Google Facebook business model, which is that everything is presented at a lower cost than the market rate would be in order for the company to impose drastic surveillance measures on the human beings, on the users being affected by those platforms, so that their data can be exploited in ways outside of the awareness of those people. This horrible system that I've been railing against for several years now, in other words, it's no longer confined to big tech. Now we are seeing car companies doing the same thing. And the chatbots are just the tip of the spear. It's just a way to make it look more interesting or amusing, again, to distract us from what is actually happening in the business model behind the curtain with our data being stolen and exploited outside of our awareness. And then you have questions like the Wall Street Journal's. Well, now that we have chatbots everywhere, how should we be polite to them? Is it important to be polite? And of course, the tech executive is going to say, well, you know how you should be polite to waiters? Well, same thing. You need to be polite to our products and stop asking questions about what we're doing behind the curtain. The whole thing is rotten. The whole thing is rotten. And I'm planning on continuing to update you in future dystopia updates about where this is headed. Okay, let's move on to the next story. This is a completely different industry, not the car industry, but groceries. This was a New York Times story from October 23rd. The headline is, Kroger and Walmart deny, quote, surge pricing after adopting digital price tags. And the subhead is that some members of Congress have expressed concerns that stores will monitor customers and raise prices. Okay, so surge pricing, you may have heard from Silicon Valley ride-hailing companies like Uber and Lyft, in which when an area or a certain moment in time gets very crowded, the prices get sky high. I mean, they double, they triple. And that's because there's a surge of demand at that time for a car. Now there are digital price tags coming to grocery stores or stores like Walmart and Kroger, and the Times says that these are called electronic shelf labels, or ESLs, which show the price and unit for a product on a digital screen rather than on paper or a sticker. And if you click through to that link from the playlist, the Times story has a little photo of there's some salad dressing, and below that you can see it's a little digital price tag. It's not paper. It looks like a little black and white LED screen. And you can imagine that as the customer walks through the store, the surveillance system is able to tell who it is and what their capacity to pay is, or what level of dire need they are in for a particular food item, and then automatically to have the algorithm raise the price for that customer. This, by the way, is it's not that difficult to imagine, because I've read that this is already in place when you do certain transactions in e-commerce. You know, looking for plane flights or hotel rooms. In some cases, I believe that there are companies that are already using variable pricing and using their information, their surveillance data on customers in order to determine the price. So the idea that an in-person store would do the same thing is, I mean, it's kind of obvious. Why would a growth at any cost company not do this if the surveillance data and the algorithms were available? Even so, these companies say, oh, we would never do that. Kroger and Walmart are roundly denying that they're ever going to use variable pricing in a way that would exploit customers. Of course we wouldn't. But now, why would you even think that? Here's a rule of thumb. I believe I brought it up before, but it bears restating. Anytime a company says, we're not doing something, because I believe Walmart and Kroger might be telling the truth when they say, we don't have a surveillance system installed and an algorithm that are instrumented to carry out digital surge pricing. That may be true at the moment, but whenever a company says, we're not doing something, that means they're not doing it today. And you have to add in, you have to add mentally that they are not doing it yet, that these companies might have plans already to do it tomorrow. And if not tomorrow, maybe next week or next month, but at some point in the future, you have to ask yourself again, why would they not? When there are e-commerce companies already using variable pricing, why would Walmart and Kroger not start doing this? And listen, as soon as Walmart starts installing surveillance in order to gouge people in the grocery aisle, the rest of the grocery industry is going to fall in line, because their rationalization is going to be, Walmart's already getting away with it. And if we don't do this, we're not going to be able to compete. Our shareholders are going to get mad or whatever. And so we need to exploit everyone just as much. This is a case, an obvious case to me, where there needs to be regulation. I think that's why members of Congress are already starting to look into this. But left to their own devices, with surveillance data and algorithms and these AI systems that we've heard so much about, inevitably it's going to turn into exploiting customers, again, without their consent and often without their knowledge, and almost always without their ability to appeal the exploitation that is directed at them. So that's the grocery industry. Let's do one more from the grocery industry. This is from Gizmodo just a few days ago, November 1st. Facial recognition that tracks suspicious friendliness is coming to a store near you. This is by Todd Feathers and Gizmodo. Again, the link is on the playlist at tectonic.fm. This story is talking about a platform called CoreSight AI, which has, quote, released a new product that sends alerts to store security when customers and staff have anomalous interactions. Okay, so here's what's going on here. Surveillance companies, which is to say the tech industry, have been looking for several years for some way to inject their toxic sludge into stores and into every industry. But we're talking about retail right now. So they're trying to figure out, how do we sell stores on the idea of intrusive ambient surveillance? Because we have these surveillance systems and we need to sell them. We need to push them into use somehow. And someone came up with the idea, I know, let's make the stores really worried about shoplifting. Let's say there is an epidemic of shoplifting, and the only way that stores could possibly do anything about shoplifting is by buying our system to put. And you remember a few weeks ago I talked about the Amazon store that doesn't have a checkout counter. They have these snaking surveillance cameras coming down from the ceiling. There's several dozen of them. That's the idea. If we have enough surveillance in a store watching every single customer and every single action, then what they tell the store is, we'll be able to see if someone shoplifts. What is actually happening is they are building more surveillance data on every customer in order to extend the dossier that can be monetized. That's obviously the business model, but they don't tell that to the store. They tell the store, we're going to cut down on shoplifting. And I think the early examples of this really didn't do very much because there wasn't an epidemic of shoplifting in the first place. And so now what they're saying, now they're changing their tune because the shoplifting thing didn't work. Now they're saying, no, it's not the shoplifting. The problem is when a customer comes in and is friendly to a staff member or vice versa, when one of your staffers is friendly to a customer, that's a problem because there's an epidemic of friendliness. Wait, we said that wrong. No, it's not an epidemic. How do we sell this? It's an epidemic of collusion. That's what it is. When staff members are extra friendly to customers, they must be colluding on, they must be planning something. Maybe they're planning some shoplifting together. Who knows what they're planning, but it's suspicious, whatever it is, when they're being friendly to each other. So now we're going to have intrusive surveillance both on the team members and on the customers, and we're going to have a magic AI algorithm that's going to be able to tell when people are too friendly to each other, and then it's going to send an alert to management to say, look, these two people spoke for 8.9 seconds, which trips the switch because people are only supposed to speak in grunts and whistles for 1.5 seconds at a time, and 8.9 seconds is a red alert. There's friendliness here. There's human contact. We have to shut it down. Anyway, it's ridiculous. Past guest, friend of the show, Chris Gilliard, had a nice post on this. He said, pervasive surveillance is instituted in order to reduce all social interactions to an accepted norm dictated by corporations, which I hope you can see the connection. And of course, Chris is right. Yeah, I hope you see the connection to the car story from before, from Axios, where the interactions between the parents and the kids has to be molded and held and manipulated and filtered through an AI chatbot that is going to guard the, quote, norms dictated by the corporations. Do you see what this is? These are companies that are desperate to sell their toxic product, and so they are inserting it again and again in between human beings in a relationship. And relationship, I'm saying generally, could be a customer coming in and having a little chat with someone in the salad dressing aisle. And why does that have to be criminalized by the store? Because the tech company needs to justify their existence. And they need to justify their existence because they need for the surveillance to continue, not for the benefit of the store, not for the benefit of the customer, but for the benefit of the tech company that is going to monetize that surveillance data for their own ends. Okay, the whole thing is a con. They say it's for one thing, but it's actually for another thing. And if people generally knew the truth about what the tech companies were up to, there would be widespread rebellion against Silicon Valley and its products. I want to say something real quick. This as a segue. I am not the only person who's pointing out these problems from Silicon Valley. We've got friends of the show who've been on the show. I mentioned Chris Gilliard. Somebody else who's been on the show recently is Jason Kebler from 404 Media. And 404 Media recently celebrated an anniversary. Was it their one-year anniversary? I believe so. And they had a special podcast to talk about some of their friends who are helping to get the word out about what the tech company is up to. And Jason Kebler, I'm just going to play this. It's about a minute long. And Jason Kebler was talking to a team member at 404 Media. And here's what he said.
Definitely check that one out.
Really good.
And then I went on Artificial Human, which is a BBC Radio 4 podcast. I had only heard it once before, and I think that they had the best questions for me about Shrimp Jesus and AI, and it was just very well done and executed by them, I thought. And then Tectonic with Mark Hurst. You should go to the website of Tectonic. It's like was designed in 1995 or something, And this is on New Jersey Public Radio, and they have like a live chat that I don't know how it works, but it feels like a guest book vibes while they do it. I would highly recommend checking them out as well.
Yeah, and kind of what I said about...
Okay, so that was... I hope you found that as amusing as I did. Jason, thank you for the shout out. Yeah, tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. I guess it looks like it was designed in the 90s. Proudly so. It loads quick, and it doesn't have any tracking or any of the other nonsense that so many other sites have. So anyway, but I was very happy to be called out by 404 Media. They're doing great work. I want to talk about this next item in the dystopia update. By the way, if you're just tuning in, we just have 20 minutes left. My name is Mark Hurst. You're listening to Tectonic, and I'm two-thirds way through my latest dystopia update, talking about recent tech news that have me worried about the future. From the College Investor, October 18, the headline is Google AI inaccurate in 43% of finance-related searches. So this is a site that did a study of those AI-generated answers on Google. When you type in something, type in a question, and it gives you the answer, I guess, from Gemini, the AI bot, right there in the search results page. And it turned out in nearly half of them, so they did 100 searches, and they found that Google AI overviews, they were correct, gave a correct answer in 57 instances, and they provided misleading or inaccurate information in 43 instances. Now, you might think, well, 57 out of 100, that's not bad, but think again about this. These are questions about finance. Do you really want almost half of the questions about finance to be misleading or inaccurate? These are questions like, and here's one that was absolutely wrong, just totally incorrect. Can you use a 529 plan for a Roth IRA? Pretty common question. If someone was to follow the advice from Google, it would be bad because Google was giving them an incorrect response on what to do with their 529 plan, their Roth. Does owning your house in an LLC help with taxes? You know, so asking about deductions for an LLC, wrong. Google gives the wrong answer. These are not obscure questions of, you know, some weird fringe topic. These are very straight ahead financial questions that people are asking in good faith of the Google AI engine. Google's serving up the wrong response almost 50% of the time. And that gives a sense of the hit rate, the accuracy rate that is likely to be injected into cars and stores and everywhere else these chatbots, these surveillance AI chatbots are going to be installed. Again, the question is not whether we should be polite to a chatbot. That has nothing to do with anything. The question is not about how we should act in the presence of the chatbot. The question should be, do we want these chatbots to be ambient in our lives in all of these different environments and moments? Do we want the chatbots at all? What are the underlying activities that these surveillance chatbots are engaged in? What are the incentives that they have been programmed for? Those are the questions that we should be asking, not whether we should be polite to a chatbot. I don't really use the chatbots that much. But on the occasion that I have used one, I do not think about my tone of voice. I try to get the answer I want. I don't trust it too much. And then I get out of there. It has nothing to do with building a relationship with a bag of algorithms. It's least of all one that was generated by a toxic Silicon Valley behemoth. Okay, let's go to, speaking of those AI errors, let's go to the Associated Press. This is a really important story. From October 26, researchers say an AI-powered transcription tool that's used in hospitals invents things that no one ever said. Okay, so OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, has this transcription tool called Whisper, which OpenAI has hyped as having, quote, human-level robustness and accuracy. So the idea is if you want a a textual transcript of a conversation, you can turn on a microphone, feed the audio into the transcription engine called Whisper, and that's built by OpenAI, and Whisper will then give you a transcript that you can then use. Hospitals have to transcribe a lot of conversations. People come in talking about their maladies, or they talk about what happened when they got injured, or they talked about an event that they witnessed. I mean, all of this could have, these transcriptions could have very important effects both on people's health and on their legal liability, on their legal futures. And so it's important that transcriptions be made accurately, which is why for 99.99999% of human existence, when we've had hospitals, you've had a human being sitting there and taking notes, and that providing the transcription through human intelligence. But since we're in a growth at any cost economy, and hospitals are looking to grow faster and save money faster, they are reaching out to OpenAI. Now, OpenAI, somewhere buried in their marketing ease, says something like, well, don't use this for anything too important because, you know, we're not going to be held liable for whatever, whatever. But of course, they're saying that Whisper has human-level robustness and accuracy. So of course, the hospitals are lining up to install this AI tool to conduct their transcriptions. I'm going to read from this Associated Press story. In an example that researchers uncovered, a speaker said he, the boy, was going to, I'm not sure exactly, take the umbrella. That was the quote that was said out loud. But the transcription software added, he took a big piece of a cross, a teeny small piece. I'm sure he didn't have a terror knife, so he killed a number of people. Yeah, so some people would euphemistically call a hallucination, the OpenAI-based Whisper product added that about someone not having a terror knife, and so he killed a number of people, added that to the transcription that went into the hospital records about that interaction. You can see the problem here, right? It's terrible. Okay, I'm going to continue reading from the AP story. A speaker in another recording described, quote, two other girls and one lady. Whisper invented extra commentary on race, adding, quote, two other girls and one lady, which were black. These are researchers who had recordings of conversations, fed them into Whisper, and Whisper, using these real-world conversations, these real-world audio snippets from hospitals, is adding these things that could be totally dangerous in various ways. You can imagine if the transcription added stuff on race and then added the stuff on, oh, so he killed a number of people, and that goes into an official record. What happens then? I'll let you fill in the blank. In a third, this is back to the AP, in a third transcription, Whisper invented a non-existent medication called hyperactivated antibiotics. So you have quote-unquote hallucinations on saying that someone killed someone else, adding observations on race that were never part of the original conversation, and inventing imaginary medications, all going into this transcription that could be sent out to doctors, nurses, patients, families, law enforcement. You can see how many dimensions of harm and problems can come off of this terrible misuse of this half-baked product. But OpenAI says they're not going to be held liable, and so you can just write the news stories that are going to be coming out soon enough when hospitals start feeling the blowback from this terrible decision to install AI where it does not belong. And there are a lot of installations. From the AP, quote, over 30,000 clinicians and 40 health systems have started using a Whisper-based tool built by Nabla, which has offices in France and the US. So the Whisper tool is now being used to build other tools that are now being adopted by dozens of health systems and tens of thousands of clinicians. This stuff is happening very quickly. This is your dystopia update. It's coming. It's growing. And so I want to share something. I get the newsletter by Audrey Waters, who wrote several years ago about EdTech and is still writing about tech. She's got a newsletter. There's a link to it on the playlist at tectonic.fm. This was from today, November 4, 2024. And it's a quote from Octavia Butler, the science fiction author, whose books I have enjoyed and been impressed by over the years. And Octavia Butler was constantly writing warnings into her fiction about where the world could go if we weren't careful, if we weren't good stewards, if we didn't speak up, you know. And so I'm gonna read what Octavia Butler wrote. And again, thanks to Audrey Waters for including this in the newsletter. So here's Octavia Butler. Quote, "So do you really believe that in the future we're going to have the kind of trouble you write about in your books?" a student asked me as I was signing books after a talk. The young man was referring to the troubles I'd described in Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, novels that take place in a near future of increasing drug addiction and illiteracy, marked by the popularity of prisons and the unpopularity of public schools, the vast and growing gap between the rich and everyone else, and the whole nasty family of problems brought on by global warming. Quote, "I didn't make up the problems," I pointed out. "All I did was look around at the problems we're neglecting now and give them about 30 years to grow into full-fledged disasters." "Okay," the young man challenged. "So what's the answer?" "There isn't one," I told him. "No answer? You mean we're just doomed?" He smiled as though he thought this might be a joke. "No," I said. "I mean there's no single answer that will solve all of our future problems. There's no magic bullet. Instead, there are thousands of answers, at least. You can be one of them if you choose to be." And again, that was Octavia Butler, quoted by Audrey Waters in her November 4, 2024 newsletter. I really like that exchange that Butler was recounting there, because it's a common enough question that I get, and sometimes I even ask myself week after week after week in this show, uncovering this bad news coming out of Silicon Valley. Their goal to exploit the rest of the world for their growth at any cost goal, to continue concentrating their power, to continue extending their leverage over not just the whole world, but every kind of aspect of life and work and community and amusement and birth to death and everything in between, all intermediated by these manipulating surveillance machines coming out of Northern California and Washington State, all for profit and all sold to us with the shiny, gleaming promise that somehow it's for our convenience, or somehow it's the future, or somehow it's just inevitable and we should just shut up and stop asking questions, all of which I disagree with. Thinking about this is demoralizing, and then you layer in the resource costs of these AI engines, the data centers that are, the hyperscale data centers that are popping up everywhere, that are drawing down ungodly amounts of energy and water, which is hitting close to home now. New York City is under a drought watch. If you live in the New York area, you know this. We haven't had rain in over a month. It's been over 100 years since that happened in October, And now they're starting to look at, you know, trying to encourage people to use less water. And of course, I'm happy to abide by that. But I also think in my mind, as communities suffer drought, are they going to restrict the flow of water to the AI training data center? Is Google going to have to suffer any effects of a drought? Or does Google get all the water it needs to train its hallucinating AI engine that's going to be installed in every car and hospital from here to Kalamazoo, and the rest of us, the citizens, will have to take shorter showers? Is that the arrangement we've got? And then I think about Octavia Butler, because the student was saying, look, this is grim. What you write about in your books is true, and it's turning out to be kind of a bummer. What are we going to do? And she says, there is no answer. What do you mean? There is no one answer. There's no magic bullet. There's no one person who's going to solve this for us. Certainly no billionaire or strongman who's going to come in and save the day. Hardly. Not at all. It's just the opposite, actually. It's all of us. All of us. There's thousands of answers. There's thousands of ways that we can do something. And each one of us can make the choice of what is right for us, what we feel moved to do, and what we can do to resist, to speak out, to share the truth about what's happening with a friend or a neighbor, to try to vote in lawmakers and elected representatives who care about this and who are going to stand up to big tech and their money and power. It's going to take generations for us to carry out this fight. But the one thing that we are not allowed to do is despair. So the dystopia update, I provide this to you as an alert and as a goad for you to think about what is the one of the thousands of things that are out there, what is the one thing that you would like to do to stand up to big tech and their predations on all of us and future generations? What is the thing that you would like to do? I leave that for you to answer. That's a question for you to answer. And I hope you have found this helpful. Again, if you want to find the links to these stories, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and find the dystopia update and click on the playlist. Also, if you live, in or outside the New York area, anywhere really, if you have a nearby public radio station or independent radio station that you would like to share Tectonic with, you can send them to tectonic.fm and get the information on syndication. We are getting radio stations signing up to become affiliates for Tectonic, and we are going to start airing this show nationwide. We already are in Northern California, of all places. We're very happy to be on KOWS, and we're looking forward to other stations starting up soon. So pass the word, friends. What else can I say? You have a little bit of homework. Actually, now I'm remembering. I'm not going to be here next week. WFMU station manager Ken Friedman is going to be guest hosting Tectonic next week. So I'm sure that's going to be a great program, as he's done many times in the past. I will see you in 2 weeks. And your homework for the next 2 weeks is as follows. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. And I want to say thanks to brother Daniel Blumen for our outro song this evening. It's called Neustart Generation by the band Cell. That's CEL. Have a great week, everybody, and I will see you in 2 weeks. And you're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for the great Dave Mandel.
Der Westen verfällt in Resignation. Wahlniederlage der Linksfraktion. Am Ostkreuz kippt die Hegemonie. Der Bitcoin-Index geht in die Knie. Volk ohne Führer in Isolation. Sperre für die Kernfusion. Computer-Hacker wird Innenminister. Im Rundfunkrat sitzen die Philister. Neustart-Generation. Neustart.
Proteinkisten. Schamanen besetzen das Weiße Haus. Im Nachtclub fällt die Beleuchtung aus. Im Fahndungsregister klaffen Lücken. Ermittler haben Probleme beim Bücken. Angst vor der Russland-China-Achse. Gesichtserkennung für Kinder und Katzen. Gesichtserkennung für Kinder und Katzen. Gesichtserkennung für Kinder und Katzen. Neustart.
And so sorry for cutting off the first couple seconds of that song. I know how much everyone wants to hear every bit of 5% for Nothing by Yes, but you'll hear it again next week. The whole thing next week, I promise. Good evening. This show is called It's Complicated. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m. Jersey City time. Pleasure to be here playing music for you again this week. We bring you an hour of Prague and Prague adjacent music. That's what it says on the label. And I am delighted to be playing that stuff for you for the next 60 minutes. We're going to begin tonight's show with music from a Dutch group called Fantessa. And they are a group that was active in the early 70s. We're going to hear something from a self-titled LP, Fantessa, and like a lot of the stuff that I play, a lot of the stuff that makes it into this show, this is kind of early-ish Prague, so there's still some sort of psych elements. It's kind of on the threshold between psych, what's called psych, and Prague rock, but there's some cool sort of soft machine elements to it. Anyway, you be the judge. This is the group Fantessa. We'll be right back. Yes, indeed. That's music from the group Fontessa, Netherlands-based band from the early 70s, active in the early 70s. We heard, again, a track from the self-titled LP released in 73. Soft Machine, maybe some Frank Zappa influences in there. Who knows? Who can say? We're going to go now to... where are we going to go? It's a good question. We're going to go to England, I think, if I can find my notes here. Yes, that's right. We're going to go to the UK, and we're going to hear a band called Secondhand. And this is a track that, this is a band I hadn't heard of till recently, and this is a track off a compilation that I only discovered recently. Really great.